This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of May 17th, 2020. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 134. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support the Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and Pacific Northwest. The Is It Just Me commentary. The big deal feature. I speak to Drew Pavlou, the Australian university student who is being threatened with expulsion by the University of Queensland for protesting against the Chinese Communist Party and its influence on campus. Drew has a cautionary message for Canadians and Americans. I also speak to Simon Fraser University professor Glenn Williams-Jones about the 40th anniversary of the Mount St. Helens eruption. Professor Williams-Jones will recall his trip inside the crater. Plus, I'll award a virtual Nanaimo bar to those making a difference. Now, is it just me? Is it just me, or should Mayor Kennedy Stewart of Vancouver and ex-Premier of British Columbia Christy Clark be up for induction to the
Politician Said What?
Hall of Fame? First up, Mayor Kennedy Stewart, a former Simon Fraser University political science professor and holder of a PhD from the London School of Economics. He's been in office since fall 2018. On May 14th, Mayor Stewart gave his weekly COVID-19 update to the media from Vancouver City Hall. He was relying on figures that he said were supplied by the Vancouver Economic Commission to tell us about the impacts to the economy.
We've had a $27 billion drop in business revenue just in April alone. And we've had 13,000, just over 13,000 businesses close. Again, really an unfathomable number when you think about the size of the economy in our city, but that's the reality here. We've had a $27 billion drop in business revenue just in April alone.
The entire Metro Vancouver region's gross domestic product was $137 billion for 2017. When I asked the mayor's office for the methodology for that $27 billion figure, I was told that Stewart was wrong. Economic activity had dropped 27%, but the real negative impact was $2 billion. That's a difference of $25 billion. Later on, CTV's John Woodward asked Mayor Stewart about a decision to cut the Vancouver Police Department's budget by 1%. Council had voted behind closed doors at an in-camera meeting a day earlier.
It seems to me to be the kind of meat and potatoes budgeting thing that the city does in public all the time. And so if you chaired that meeting, I wanted to know why you allow such important information about city budgets and public safety that citizens need to know to be done in secret.
Yeah, again, characterizing it as secret is a bit of a stretch. I mean, there is a process under the Vancouver Charter under which, through the clerk's office, we determine what issues go on camera and which issues do not.
That's right. Mayor Kennedy Stewart scoffed at a reporter for calling an in-camera meeting secret. Oxford says in-camera meetings are meetings that are held in private with the press and the public excluded. Synonyms include such words as confidentially and secretly. Next up, Christy Clark, who was BC's premier from 2011 to 2017. She was on the Renew Canada webinar on May 14th talking about how shovel-ready infrastructure projects could help dig Canada out of recession. She outlined her philosophy on big-ticket projects.
So what we did is we went to the federal government, and you know, it was the Harper Conservatives at the time. They were very much of the same view as we were, which was, if you invest in infrastructure money that is going to go to projects that are going to create more economic opportunity, so that's roads, rail, ports, bridges, that, you know, basically the gateway, then you're going to see a huge economic opportunity created in mines, in LNG. Like, we weren't that, at the time, we weren't that interested in building hospitals and water parks and all those other things, which are important, but they don't have a lot of economic spinoff. And so we really found a lot of common ground very early with the federal government around that stuff.
That's right. Ex-BC Liberal Premier Clark suggested that hospitals and water parks are the same type of infrastructure. All of you listening will understand the difference. It's very simple. We can do without water parks. We cannot do without hospitals. Why do hospitals not belong in the same sentence as water parks? Well, what do hospitals bring that water parks don't? Spin-offs from medical and scientific research. Spin-offs from jobs, jobs, jobs. Hospitals are major employers. And the intangibles. Can you put a price on public health and community wellness? A healthy community will obviously have higher economic productivity and lead to better social outcomes. I wish Ms. Clark the best of health, but I do hope the next time she may need treatment for an illness or an injury, that she visits the nearest hospital, not her nearest water park. What do you think? Email bob@thebreaker.news.
You gotta do what?
What?
Dr. Henry said, we're gonna have to wait to vaccinate. So just stay strong and sing this song. You gotta wash your hands. Don't touch your face.
John Mitchell and his Vancouver Independent single, Do What?
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In stuff.co.nz, Maori performing arts teacher commemorates COVID-19 crisis with haka. The nation's experience of disruption and uncertainty through the coronavirus emergency has been commemorated in a haka. If you've seen the New Zealand All Blacks play rugby, you've seen and heard the haka. Maori performing arts teacher Hoteri Putawa has been hosting online kapa haka sessions every weekday from his lower hut home since the beginning of the Alert Level 4 lockdown. He composed Mate Corona E while in lockdown to make Maori storytelling relevant to his students. The three parts of the haka cover the arrival of the virus in New Zealand, the lockdown, and the key messages about staying safe. Listen to this.
Noho ki te kāinga kia haumaru te noho, stay home, stay safe, which was probably one of the biggest messages that our children were hearing. And then it says, horoia o ringaringa, you know, to wash your hands.
Noho ki te kāinga kia haumaru te noho, horoia o ringaringa, tu tīrāra noho tawhititu.
And then the final part of that haka was noho tawhiti tu kotahi. So again, there was another message that our children were hearing, and that was to stay apart, but to stand together.
Kyoto in the Japan Times. Sumo wrestler Shibushi, 28, is sports' first coronavirus death. Kiyotaka Suitake, the first sumo wrestler to die from the pneumonia-causing virus, is also thought to be the first person in their 20s to die from the virus in Japan. Fourth-tier Rikishi from Takadagawa Stable spent over 3 weeks in intensive care. The stable master and five wrestlers tested positive last month. The summer grand sumo tournament in Tokyo from May 24th to June 7th was cancelled by the pandemic. Jane Chai, Huafeng, and Zhuang Pingwei in the South China Morning Post. Class and the coronavirus. As China's wealthy cut back on life's luxuries, the nation's poorest are in a fight for survival. Migrant workers and the residents of rural areas are bearing the brunt of the employment crisis in China caused by COVID-19. And while many factories in the nation's industrial heartland have reopened, a slump in global demand for Chinese goods has dimmed hopes of a swift end to their problems. According to a report by the Economist Intelligence Unit on April 22nd, China's unemployment rate could reach 10% this year, with the loss of a further 22 million jobs in urban areas. UBS estimated in a report published last month that 50 million to 60 million jobs had been lost in the services sector and a further 20 million in the industrial and construction sectors. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Those were the voices of Katrina Chen and Bowen Ma, with music by Bob Deeth, covering Avril Lavigne's Keep Holding On. All three are BC NDP MLAs.
Now it's time on the break. Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
Ted Sickinger in the Oregonian. The truth is, Multnomah County is not ready to reopen. Multnomah County officials say they need more money, more contact tracers, more personal protection equipment, and more time before they can hope to join 31 other Oregon counties that the governor approved to begin a gradual reopening. Multnomah County is a major economic engine for the state, but is home to 20% of the state's population, has 27% of the coronavirus cases, and 40% of the deaths in the state. Associated Press in the Olympian. National Guard helps hand out free potatoes in Tacoma. Cars lined up near the Tacoma Dome in Tacoma to receive the bags of potatoes as part of a mission to get 1 million pounds of potatoes into the hands of people in need. The giveaway of 200,000 pounds of spuds was organized by the Washington State Potato Commission. Meanwhile, Republican Representative Matt Shea was fined almost $5,000 for dumping olive oil on the state capitol steps in March after a protest by Satanists. Shea was with a group of Christian counter-protesters. The olive oil permanently damaged some of the stones. Graham Cox and Corey Sidaway of Czech News, one in five BC nonprofits at risk of closure due to COVID-19. According to a recent survey conducted by Vantage Point, 15 to 19% of nonprofits face closure, and 23% feel they may not last more than 6 months under the current crisis conditions. The survey of more than 1,100 nonprofits around BC found 74% of nonprofits have experienced a decrease in funding, 68% have struggled to manage working from home, 95% report higher stress levels because of COVID-19. The data also points to 40% of nonprofits having to lay off staff or anticipate laying off staff. And these headlines this week in the Breaker.News. KN95 rejection angers mask supplier to Vancouver's Chinese consulate. More than 3 years later, no charges in BC Liberal Party's cash for access scandal. John Horgan's wordsmith now paid to lobby the NDP government. Read the stories behind these headlines. Go to the Breaker.News. That's Jimmy Buffett with his 1979 MCA Records single, Volcano. We are looking back 40 years ago to May 18, 1980, the day that Mount St. Helens erupted, one of the biggest natural disasters in recent history in North America. I was a young 9-year-old lad at the Cub Scouts Camp Bing near Roberts Creek. 500 kilometers north, we heard the blast on BC's Sunshine Coast.
Now, KOMO News 4, Sunday.
Good evening. Mount St. Helens will never be the same again. Perhaps all of us will never be quite the same, never so smug about our ability to control Mother Nature, to try to predict, to deal with the terrible, awesome forces that shape this fragile slice of earth we live on. This morning's violent eruption has killed at least 5 people. At least 3 others are still reported missing. Air Force Reserve rescue crew choppers spotted 2 bodies at a Weyerhaeuser logging camp. An officer said the 2 apparently killed by intense heat. The State Department of Emergency Services says 3 more are dead. We don't know the circumstances of their deaths yet. This is the black cloud of smoke and ash that poured, billowed up from the top of Mount St. Helens shortly after 8:30 this morning. One eyewitness described this day as looking like the end of the world. The end started at 8:32 a.m. when 2 strong quakes measuring 5 or 5.1 on the Richter scale rocked the volcano almost simultaneously. This view, 25 miles west of St. Helens at an altitude almost equal to the top of the mountain as you look down on part of the Toutle River Valley. It was followed by a rolling series of harmonic tremors showing magma, molten rock on the move deep inside the volcano. 7 minutes later, 8:39, a tremendous blast shattered the Sunday morning calm. A blast heard as far away as Vancouver, British Columbia, a blast some say that rocked the courthouse in Port Angeles. Smoke and ash billowed 66,000 feet, almost 10 miles above the summit of the 9,600-foot mountain. The northwest face is reportedly blown off. New steam vents reported it triggered mudslides that you can see here on the north and south forks of the Toutle River. A 12 to 20-foot wall of mud, water, and trees came crashing down the mountain at 20 to 25 miles an hour. Corps racing through the Toutle River Valley.
Now the island is shifting, plates are lifting, Corps is screaming, dies out of dreaming, stopped up a steaming, the happy campers.
Joining us from Simon Fraser University on Burnaby Mountain in British Columbia is Professor Glyn Williams-Jones. He is co-director of the Center for Natural Hazards Research at Simon Fraser University. Professor Williams-Jones focuses on physical volcanology and has studied volcanoes in the Americas, Hawaii, and Southeast Asia. First of all, where were you on that day, May 18th, 1980, when Mount St. Helens erupted?
I was actually in Montreal. Don't remember a whole lot about it because I was fairly young. But actually, one of my professors was busy testing an instrument that we use to monitor volcanoes, but he was in Montreal. Detected the gas coming from the eruption of Mount St. Helens all the way across the country. It was a couple of days later. So this was really a powerful eruption. It's important to actually put it into the context. Compared to many other volcanoes, it was a pretty small eruption, but it was in North America, and there were all of these scientists watching it. And so we've learned a huge amount of information about this volcano and about volcanoes in general.
I've got a souvenir jar of ash, but that's quite fascinating that the remnants, the gas, could flow that far away to the other side of the continent.
Yeah, and you mentioned the ash. There was actually ash blown all the way into Canada. People in the Pemberton area of BC mentioned sort of hearing the explosion. One of my colleagues at the University of Alberta has actually been researching the volcanic ash from Mount St. Helens, and in fact reaching out to citizen scientists to ask people, where were you, what do you remember, to try to better map out how far the ash went.
Now, you have studied Mount St. Helens up close. You've been closer than most people. You actually went into the crater in 2004. Describe that experience.
Yeah, it was really a powerful experience. I was there with a group of undergraduate students from Simon Fraser University. I'd only been at SFU just a year when the opportunity came to take this field trip. And we were there maybe only about 2 weeks before it reactivated. It was an amazing place. This big open horseshoe crater with this huge dome of lava that had pushed its way through back in the 80s. And surrounded by one of the youngest glaciers that had formed right after the eruption. So it's an incredible environment and still really picturesque.
What did you learn from that site visit? What kind of research flowed and conclusions flowed from that site visit?
Yeah, I mean, that was more of a teaching visit, mainly focusing on trying to expose the undergraduate students to what it's like to be in an active system. But the community as a whole, especially the United States Geological Survey, who are responsible for the monitoring, have learned a huge amount of information from the 1980 eruption and then the following eruption reactivation in 2004. Some of the features that we see on the side of the volcano, these hummocky surfaces, basically bumps and troughs and so on, these we'd seen examples of these from around the world in Chile and other countries, and yet had not understood how they formed. And it was watching Mount St. Helens fall apart as half the volcano blew itself to bits, and all of the side of the volcano created one of the largest observed landslides. That was what formed these impressive features. So looking at St. Helens, we were able to look back at other volcanoes around the world and go, aha, that's what happened. So for even though it was a small eruption in the scheme of things, we've learned a huge amount from that and moving on.
Now, here in Vancouver, we are surrounded by volcanoes. On a clear day, we can see Mount Baker in the east. And from Howe Sound, we can see Mount Garibaldi. Those are the picture postcard volcanoes that a lot of people don't realize are volcanoes. There are many others in British Columbia, but with Mount Baker, which is just over the line in Washington State, and of course Mount Garibaldi up sea to sky, how active are they, and might we see any major activity in our lifetimes?
So, I mean, that's always the million-dollar question. Mount Baker was most recently active in the late 70s, and it was mainly sort of things had warmed up, a small amount of magma intruded beneath the volcano, and people could see steam blast happening at the summit, but it sort of went quiet. And it is important to consider Mount Baker because volcanoes ignore borders. But again, closer to home, if we go up the sea to sky, there are, in fact, volcanoes that they don't stop at the border. Mount Garibaldi, as you mentioned. And more recently, we've been working on Mount Meager, just northwest of Pemberton, which since 2016, we actually saw these large ice caves form and volcanic gas have melted their way through. And so it's by no means extinct. We have our own active volcano. And it, when it last erupted, it was about 2,400 years ago, it would have been of the same scale as the 1980 eruption of Mount St. Helens. 2,400 years ago sounds like a long time, but in the scale of the Earth, in geological time, that's yesterday. It's a blink of the eye. So we've got volcanoes. We're trying to build our ability to monitor them. It's really impossible to say if we'll get an eruption in Canada in our lifetimes, but if we don't look, then we don't know.
Now, we're faced with so many different challenges from the natural environment. I mean, we're in the middle of a pandemic right now. For a number of years, scientists have been trying to learn more about the climate change, earthquake, seismology. That's also one that we're keenly aware of and concerned about. From being on the West Coast, with the volcanoes and the uncertainty about when we might see any activity, major activity, if ever, during our lifetimes or even our grandchildren's lifetimes, but it could happen. How has technology improved to allow people like you to better understand what's going on underneath and to prepare us for when there might be major activity that would be a major danger to human life?
Technology changes have been incredible. And really the biggest changes has been the drop in cost. There's a whole suite of new, very small, very inexpensive sensors that we can now start to deploy around volcanoes. I mean, it's no matter what natural hazard you're trying to study, it's always a budget issue. There's a cost-benefit analysis, which is more likely, which is more impactful. But frankly, there's a lot of very interesting work that's been done, new small earthquake sensors, small seismometers that are $500 or $600. We can start to think about disposable sensors. So these are some things that we're actually trying to do, and in fact bring in citizen science collaborators, just the normal public interested in helping build these low-cost sensors and deploy them around the volcanoes, and all these other types of things like landslides, the large earthquakes that we're concerned about here on the West Coast. With all of that data, we are starting to then be in a position where, and in conjunction with these new developments in computer science and artificial intelligence, bringing all of these tools together, we're actually in a much better position than we have ever been to get a better understanding of what those signals mean. Is that volcano just grumbling along quietly, or is it showing signs of something imminent? So these are the things that we're trying to understand. But it's a complex system. And I always say, look how good we are at forecasting the weather on the West Coast. two, 3 days in advance were probably pretty good. But anything beyond that, it's really complicated, understandable, big chaotic system. Take that same level of chaos and complexity and put it underground, where all of our measurements are inferred. We can't see it. We've got to almost guess at it. So we've got a long way to go. And you mentioned COVID. I think the one main thing is this is actually making people more aware of the importance of getting more and more information, more data, and starting to build, to be prepared, build resiliency in communities in eventual case that we have to respond to some type of, you know, a volcanic eruption.
Thanks again to Professor Glenn Williams-Jones, professor at Simon Fraser University in the Center for Natural Hazards Research, for joining us to talk about volcanoes as the 40th anniversary of the Mount St. Helens eruption is upon us. That is Volcano by the Presidents of the United States of America from their 1996 Columbia Records released second album. The version is from King 5 Seattle's Almost Live, featuring a cameo by Washington Governor Gary Locke. Joining me on Skype from Brisbane, Australia is Drew Pavlou. Drew Pavlou is a philosophy student at the University of Queensland and a member of the University Senate. Pavlou has spoken out about the Chinese Communist Party's influence on campus. He has led protests against the crackdown on Hong Kong's democracy movement and the mass jailing of Uyghur Muslims in Xinjiang. Drew Pavlou is now fighting to stay on campus. He is facing a closed-doors misconduct hearing where he may be expelled. Drew, universities are supposed to be places where people are supposed to go and learn and share ideas, a place for free speech. Did you ever expect to find yourself in this position?
I never did expect myself to, like, be in this situation where I am today. The University of Queensland, I guess, has this motto, and it's carved into the stone of the Forgan Smith Building, which is, like, I guess the great center of campus. And this motto is, I guess, like, a call for the university to be a place of light, liberty, and learning. And what does it mean to be a university, or like a place of light, liberty, and learning? I think that goal, you know, of the university can only be achieved, you know, when freedom of speech is rigorously upheld, when ideas are tested and challenged in a rigorous way, when, you know, students are able to, like, participate in a marketplace of ideas and contest one another's opinions and viewpoints, and in a rigorous and, you know, challenging way. That's how we learn, that's how we grow, that's how we advance as, like, as a society. That like great contest of ideas, I suppose. And I never expected my university to be so beholden to Chinese government influence and money that it would now be prepared to expel me as a student due to my very, like, vocal calls for the university to divest from its relationship with the Chinese government while the Chinese government persecutes the Uyghur Muslims and cracks down on Hong Kong and Tibet and the people of China itself in really a morally catastrophic way. For me, it was always about fighting to uphold the human rights and the human dignity of the Chinese people, the Tibetan people, the Uyghur and Hong Kong people. Because fundamentally, I believe all human beings are born equal in status and dignity and value. And that is why I challenge my university's relationship with the Chinese government, because the Chinese government participates in such egregious moral crimes on such a vast scale. And it was really trying to say, do we want to be a part of these crimes by doing business with this government? It's about trying to uphold our own values. How can we uphold our own democratic values and our belief in the universe, in the universality of human rights, when we are doing business with a government that operates concentration camps? And I've made this argument very vocally on campus. I've held protests, I've held rallies challenging my university's position on this issue. And now the university's, I guess the university's response has been to, you know, send me this 186-page dossier filled with allegations, really threatening my enrollment. The outcome of this whole process, there will be a hearing May 20th, and following the outcome of this process, I've been informed, you know, like one outcome may be the voiding of my enrollment, my expulsion from my university. I'm someone who has like 6-7 months left on my degree. I've spent $30,000 in student fees, and we're talking, I would lose 3.5 years worth of study, $30,000 worth of fees, all just like that in the blink of an eye. Because I decided to speak out and question whether we were living up to our values, whether we were living up to that ideal of being a place of light, liberty, and learning by developing and cultivating ties with the government that, you know, I believe is carrying out a genocide against the Uyghur Muslim people with 1.5 million Muslims in concentration camps. It's really about asking, can we in good conscience continue to do business with a government that is carrying out these terrible human rights abuses? And because the money is just so significant to the university, we're talking hundreds of millions of dollars a year. And when we look at it on a broader time frame, when we look at it over a decade or more, we're talking the Chinese market being worth billions to the University of Queensland. And the Chinese government, it ties its economic heft to its political goals, you know. It can, because it's a totalitarian government, decide tomorrow the University of Queensland is too politically sensitive a campus to allow Chinese students to study at. And that would mean the insolvency of the University of Queensland. It would mean the loss of billions of dollars in revenue into the future. So our university has allowed itself to be brought into a position where it can be made bankrupt overnight if it does not do the bidding of the Chinese government, if it doesn't, I guess, carry out the political goals of the Chinese Communist Party. If it were to be seen to be, you know, coming into opposition with the party and with party officials by, say, allowing pesky students like me to protest vocally on campus about the Chinese government's human rights abuses, then the Chinese Communist Party can punish the university by functionally rendering it insolvent overnight and, like, gutting billions of dollars in funding into the future. So that's really the danger, I think, in allowing ourselves to get to that point where the Chinese government has that kind of leverage over our institutions in a democratic society. And, you know, sadly, I'm just the piggy in the middle, I suppose, like between the university and this tyrannical government. My right to free speech as an Australian citizen, I guess the university's more than happy steamrolling. I guess the university's more than happy to steamroll that right to free speech as an Australian citizen to avoid being bankrupted by the Chinese government.
Now, the programs at the university have been actually funded by the Chinese government. You've got the vice chancellor there, Peter Hoi. He's actually been advisor to the Beijing organization that is ultimately responsible for the Confucius Institutes. He's received payment for what he's done. And the consul general for China in Brisbane was actually appointed as an adjunct professor at the university. So this isn't just about foreign students. This is getting ties at the highest level of the university where they are having access.
Our vice chancellor, for his work with Hanban, the Chinese government organization that oversees Confucius Institutes worldwide, our vice chancellor, Peter Hoi, was awarded the Most Outstanding Individual of the Year award in 2015 by China's vice premier for his, quote, efforts promoting Confucius Institutes worldwide. So, you know, he's been a very active participant and an active agent promoting the interests of this government. And we recently found out today, just this morning, we found out from whistleblower documents within the university that last year, Peter Hoi, the vice chancellor, was afforded $200,000 in a bonus on top of his $1.2 million salary tied, and that bonus was tied to a KPI that basically stated that he was to do everything in his power to deepen the university's ties with this government and deepen the university's ties with the Chinese Communist Party state. He's directly financially incentivized by the university to, you know, develop ties with this government. And that's what he does, because ultimately people listen to their hip pocket. We're not talking about, I guess, the university administration being, I mean, staffed with secret adherence to Xi Jinping thought on Chinese socialism for a new era. We're not talking about, you know, these people being ideological adherents to, like, whatever the Chinese Communist Party represents these days. We're talking about people who have made a very cold, brutal economic calculation, what's best for my hip pocket. And unfortunately, you know, they've been prepared to sell out democratic values, some of the most important values we hold dear in Australia, simply for private personal economic gain. It's a process of elite capture, and the Chinese Communist Party has really perfected it over the past few decades, and we're now seeing it in action. And Australia is really the canary in the coal mine when it comes to this type of thing. Unfortunately, we're going to be seeing it all across, I guess, democracies into the future. We'll see it in Canada, we'll see it in the United States, we'll see it in New Zealand, we'll see it everywhere, really. We'll see it in the European Union and Great Britain. It's a process of elite capture. The Chinese Communist Party has perfected it over decades, and now we are waking up to it, but it seems like we are waking up to it far too late, and that's really the really horrifying and terrifying thing. And we are now, like, really forced to reckon with the fact that we've basically, you know, we've been sleepwalking the past 30 years. We knew this government, Tiananmen occurred 1989. We knew what this government was like then. That was the true face of this government, rolling over students with tanks, crushing their legs and their bodies beneath, like, tank machinery. That was the true face of this government. The world learned it in 1989. And yet we've somehow been sleepwalking for 30 years.
You're in the final days and hours of preparing your defense for that May 20th hearing to make sure you continue to study at the University of Queensland. But as you prepare that, as you take your time out, and thank you for joining us on the Breaker.News podcast, what is your message to students, faculty, and others at universities in North America, in Europe, looking at your situation? What is your advice to students and faculty elsewhere who may face the same resistance to freedom of speech, to them on campus, from forces, from foreign governments, especially from the Chinese government?
Yeah, sure. So I think we need to consider, really, why does the Chinese Communist Party want students overseas to be expelled for criticizing the Chinese Communist Party? And we saw that, you know, the Chinese state media literally put out an article basically condemning me as an enemy of the Chinese state and calling for my expulsion. And we should ask, why is it that the Chinese Communist Party would do such a thing? Why do they care about citizens in a foreign country speaking out against their regime? And I think they want to signal with my case that their reach is now such that there will be consequences for speaking out against the Chinese Communist Party in Australia, Canada, New Zealand, the United States, the European Union, Britain, all across the world. There will be consequences for that. I think they want to demonstrate that they have this type of economic leverage over us. It's really, it's to some extent a terror tactic. It's basically, I guess, an attempt to try and, it's an attempt to chill, I guess, the public debate, try and scare people into submission. I would really encourage everyone in the world, you know, who loves justice, loves human rights, loves human dignity, that cares about these universal democratic human rights, these universal democratic values, that cares about universal human rights. I'd really encourage everyone, you know, to continue speaking out. Don't give in. Don't let this, you know, this attempt to shut down free speech succeed by, you know, like, giving into, like, you know, their attempt to instill terror and fear into, like, the hearts of people worldwide when it comes to speaking out on these issues. Don't let yourself, I guess, you know, don't let yourself, I guess, capitulate to this type of, like, bullying, thuggery, and intimidation. We really need to continue fighting for human dignity, human rights, democracy. These are universal, fundamental values. We can't give them up simply because the Chinese Communist Party, simply because the Chinese Communist Party wants to silence us. We can't give in to that sort of bullying and thuggery. So I would please, you know, exhort everyone, like, who might listen to this case and care about what's happening here, you know, don't let it scare you away from, you know, criticizing this government. Let it instead steal your resolve to continue speaking out and fighting for human dignity, human rights, and justice. Yeah, thank you.
That was my interview with Drew Pavlou, a philosophy student at the University of Queensland in Brisbane, Australia. The University of Queensland has not released the case against Drew Pavlou. On May 9th, it issued a statement that said that the university rejects recent unsubstantiated accusations about any political motivations. The university has always been transparent about its international engagements. On May 13th, the University of Queensland issued another statement that said that fees from Chinese students account for approximately 20% of the university's revenue, and China is one of the university's largest research partners.
Lots of toilet paper, but rare trips to the loo. All was Gordon was just wrong. What nervous people do. Seeing the world out my window, the right thing to do. Isolation's what I'm in. I got the COVID-19 blues. We should have thought ahead. First China, then Iran. This is my first pandemic. I'm doing all I can. I wash my hands with soap, water, sanitizer too. I douse myself in vodka just to spend some time with you.
The COVID-19 Blues by the Accutones. The voice of the Accutones is Richmond, BC lawyer Paul Doroshenko of Acumen Law, VancouverCriminalLaw.com.
The virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to a person or group that is making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to Prince George Secondary School teacher Eric Vliegenhardt, who is behind the prep and delivery of 600 lunches to needy students who are missing school because of the pandemic. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca.
You gotta help your neighbors all across this land. And the frontline workers who fight to keep us safe. They are brave souls. I'm amazed, 'cause we're all in this together, and we've got to brave this stormy weather.
Burnaby City Councillor Joe Keithley of DOA and Mayor Mike Hurley with "We're All in This Together." That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of May 17th, 2020. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on May 17th in 1977, Atari founder Nolan Bushnell opened the first Chuck E. Cheese's in San Jose, California, revolutionizing the video game, pizza, and children's birthday experience? Now you know. Send me your feedback and send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit TheBreaker.News on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. Be like Paul Doroshenko, who is at the $10 a month NewsHound level of support for TheBreaker.News. For more information, go to patreon.com/TheBreakerNews. That's patreon.com/TheBreakerNews. Playing us out is North Vancouver District Councillor Jordan Back and North Vancouver Lonsdale NDP MLA Bowen Ma with their COVID-19 version of John Denver's Take Me Home Country Road, recorded live outside the Evergreen House Seniors Home in North Vancouver on May 9th. Until next week.
All our elders gather around here, but because of COVID, we can't get too near. Days are lonely, lonelier than the nights. But we will get through this. We won't go without a fight. Can't wait to go
to his home, where my grandpa, he lives alone. We will beat this COVID-19 and free our neighbors from their homes. You hear the cheering every dinner hour.
Saving lives,
can't wait to go.